This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
We're going to talk now about the story of a woman named Jane and her brother Benjamin. When they were young, they were called Jenny and Benny.
And they were very close. Benny wrote this about his relationship with his sister. The two eyes of a man do not more resemble, nor are capable of being upon better terms with each other than my sister and myself.
Jenny agreed. We had seldom any contention among us, she wrote. All was harmony.
They loved each other dearly. They teased each other. In response to Jenny's claim that all was harmony, Benny wrote, I think our family were always subject to being a little miffy.
You introduce your reproof of my miffy temper so politely, she joked back. One can't avoid wishing to have conquered it as you have.
However, their letters also revealed that Jenny spelled poorly. She never learned how to hold a pen properly. She married at 15, had 12 children, only one of whom survived her.
Her brother, however, became one of the founding fathers of the United States.
Benny's full name was Benjamin Franklin. Jenny was his sister, Jane Franklin Meekham. His most beloved sibling, yet someone he never once mentions in his own memoirs.
Now, if Ben Franklin was the legendary revolutionary everyman, historian Jill Lepore writes that Jane was everyone else. She tells Jane's little-known life story in Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard University and a frequent contributor and staff writer to The New Yorker magazine. She joins us in the studio now. Jill Lepore, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, fantastic book. Congratulations on it being shortlisted for the National Book Award for Nonfiction.
Thank you very much.
It's a very well-deserved accolade. So let's dive into the life of Jane Franklin. But if we can, I was wondering if you might start by reading us something. It's the letter or an excerpt from a letter, the earliest surviving letter that Jane Franklin ever wrote from 1758 when she was 45 years old.
I wish I could do it in a full-throttled 18th century Boston accent. I think just sort of hear it in your strongest South Boston accent, which is, I think, a very good approximation of 18th century Boston. Dear sister, for so I must call you, come what will, and if I don't express myself proper, you must excuse it, seeing I have not been accustomed to pay my compliments to governor and baronet's ladies. I am in the midst of a great wash, and Sarah is still sick, and I would gladly have been excused writing this post, but my husband says I must write and give you joy, which we sincerely join in. I suppose it will not be news to you, but I will tell you how I came by it. Mr. Flucker told Cousin Williams, and he, Dr. Perkins, who brought it to my poor son Nettie, who has had another relapse into raising blood, and has not done one stroke of work this month, but was just going to begin when he was taken ill. Pray pardon my bad writing and confused composure, and accept it as coming from your ladyship's affectionate sister and most obedient, humble servant, Jane Meekham.
Now, first of all, we have to say that that letter, even though it's from Jane Franklin and intended for her brother Benjamin Franklin, she didn't write that one in particular directly to Ben Franklin.
Right. This is to his wife. She knows he's going to read it, but this is to his wife, Deborah.
And this was because she had found out through the grapevine, essentially, as she describes, that there was a rumor that Ben Franklin had been given a title of some kind.
Yeah, that he'd been named a baron. And so it's she was a very miffy person. And so was Franklin. Franklin just had other guises for his miffiness. But so, you know, this is very frank. She has this quite conversational writing style. She really wrote exactly the way she spoke. She was uneducated, so she didn't know how to do anything else except to write down what she would say if someone were sitting right next to her. So it's like, you know, it's just full of jabs. How could you possibly be a baron, first of all? But second of all, if you were, why am I the last person to know about it?
Yeah, and by the way, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge from your humble servant and all that stuff. So, I mean, you get a sense as to the voice of who this woman was when she was 45. And I want to talk to you in a little bit about just that fact that of the many, many letters she wrote, we have to wait until she's 45 in our present day to see these letters, because not many or zero of them before 1758 actually do exist. But let's even move further back in time, though, and talk about the childhood of Benjamin Franklin and Jane Franklin. Ben Franklin was the youngest son, but Jane was the youngest of the Franklin children. What was their relationship like as children?
Well, so there's 10 boys and 7 girls, and their father is a poor candle maker and soap boiler in Boston, and they're the closest of all the Franklin children. And we know this from what they say later on in their life, but we don't have to wait as long as till Jane gets to be 45, but because Benjamin writes about earlier. They were called Benny and Jenny. Everybody in their family thought of them as the two that were most alike. I think that their attachment as children displays itself over the course of their lives. Franklin writes more letters to Jane than he writes to anyone else. Their correspondence, you know, begins the day he turns 21. He runs away when he's 17, and the first letter he writes home is to Jane on his 21st birthday. And
their correspondence continues for over 60 years.
Yeah, for over 60 years. And, you know, it's full of expressions of affection. And Franklin doesn't have that run of correspondence with anyone else in his family. The two of them live longer than anyone else who's left, for one thing. But they often recall how special they are to one another. And the way that people talk about them too, like Franklin, you know, we know a lot about who Franklin was, right? He talks about himself. He was very saucy and he was very rebellious. And he wants to describe his personality as that of like the allegorical American. Like he won't stand for tyranny and he'll always fight the good fight and he knows it's important to do good and he will not accept arbitrary power. But Jane is actually the same way. So there's a lot of elements of their personality that are quite similar.
Yeah, I mean, you write how in childhood, Franklin was that precocious, quote, startling and adventurous boy who did everything from keeping pigeons to blowing soap bubbles out of his father's pipe, which would have delighted his baby sister at the time. So very much alike in temperament, but, you know, by virtue of one being a boy and the other being a girl, almost nothing like each other in terms of the, you know, their earliest access to education.
Yeah, no, their lives couldn't have been more different. It's interesting because there's this classic, like, a lot of Enlightenment thought experiments work this way. What if there was a boy and a girl and they were born at the same time, they were twins, and they entered society and were raised as a boy and a girl would be, but they were born with the same natural genius, as we would say in the 18th century. How would their lives transpire? Well, this isn't a thought experiment. This is actually, you can watch how this happens. I mean, Franklin is born in 1706. Jane is born in 1712, and they live, you know, into the 1790s, so you can watch sort of the 18th century evolve. But what the 18th century meant for boys and girls and the different ways that they were supported and their education was supported, boys learned how to read and write, and girls only learned how to read.
Right. And I mean, in fact, you point out that at the time of Jane Franklin's birth in the colonies, only, what, 2 out of 5 women even knew how to sign their names.
Yeah. And that's really, for those who could do that, that's really usually all they knew how to do.
Wow. You know, you point out that for any additional education in the letters and writing that Jane Franklin may have received in those early years of her life, it was because Ben Franklin taught her.
Yeah, I really do think that. I mean, their correspondence has that feel, right? She's always apologizing for specific errors that she's made, and he'll correct her. When you did learn how to write, you would often do so through a correspondence. It's sort of like a master tutor thing. And that's, their correspondence has that their whole lives. Yeah. So I think there's all kinds of reasons to think that, right? Like Franklin believed passionately in education. This, you know, he talks in his autobiography about having this debate with his good friend John Collins when they were printer's apprentices together in Boston in the 1720s over whether girls should be educated. They had this, and Franklin took the side that girls should be educated and cited all these arguments that had been made by people who said, you know, actually maybe it would be a good idea to teach girls how to write. You know, he lost the debate, but there's, you know, it's very active in his mind that we know that. That's very well established. He's this young man who's fascinated by this, among many other questions. Right. But should girls be educated? I think that's because of Jane.
Yeah. Well, so I love the fact that in the book, Book of Ages, you reprint verbatim several excerpts from the letters and the writings that we do have of Jane Franklin, and they are full of these touching misspellings and grammar that seems, I mean, it seems very 18th century, but also maybe not exactly as a fully educated person might have written. And she frequently apologizes for her bad spelling. I mean, there's one letter in which she writes, "I have such poor faculty at making letters. Is there not a little..." Then Ben writes back to her, sort of in their teasing relationship, "Is there not a little affectation in your apology? Perhaps it is rather fishing for commendation. You write better, in my opinion," says Benjamin Franklin to his sister, "than most American women." And you write that that's true.
Yeah, it is true. He also completely had her number. she knows she's late in life. She finally reveals that she understands that she is a person of superior understanding, and she's impatient with people who don't have the kind of understanding that she has. So you can see she has fought really hard to kind of develop her powers of thinking, and she's very proud of it, and she does fish for accommodation. But it is staggering to think about it. I think it's really, We carry around in our heads, so many of us, I think, a notion that the only people who lived in the 18th century were like Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, George Washington, and John Hancock or something. But really, that's just not the case. I mean, Jane is a really good proxy for most ordinary people's experience, not just for women, but for many men who were very poorly educated too, of course. But it's really interesting, I think, to juxtapose the two of them because we see so much more.
Mm. Well, but particularly with Jane, I would say that she does give voice to the experience of women at that time because, you know, while her beloved brother, Benjamin, runs away and ends up being a man of the world and, you know, a leading light of the American Revolution, she got married at the age of 15.
Yeah, which, you know, was illegal at the time. The legal age was 16. The average age for anybody to marry was 24. Benjamin got married at 24. All her other sisters and brothers got married like 23, 24, 25. So it was a very odd thing. She probably was pregnant and lost a child. And she's pregnant again pretty soon afterwards. She has her first baby at 17. She's pregnant or nursing for the next, you know, 24 years straight. So when Franklin runs away and, you know, opens up a printing shop and then opens a library in Philadelphia and he says how he devotes an hour or two each day to reading in his library to make up for the loss of his education because he was too poor to go to Harvard, this the woman with 12 children who's also taking care of her elderly parents is not devoting 2 hours each day to reading. It's just it's not physically possible. Like, it's hard to imagine how anyone could have gotten really very much sleep under such circumstances.
Yeah. Listeners, I'm speaking with Jill Lepore. She's a professor of history at Harvard University and author of the new book, Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Now, Jill Lepore, there are a fraction of the number of letters that that Jane Franklin actually wrote to her brother Benjamin that exist, vis-a-vis the she kept everything that he ever sent to her. But the title of your book, Book of Ages, comes from a thing that she herself, Jane Franklin, created and called the Book of Ages. So first of all, describe it. What is it?
Yeah, it's this tiny little pamphlet. I mean, picture something, you know, it's sort of as rough as burlap. I mean, it's a homemade paper she made herself. She took four sheets of foolscap and folded them and stitched them together with some thread. So it's this little tiny book of 16 pages. It's here in an archive in Boston. It's amazing that it was saved. And on the front page, she's written in this really lavish hand, just these three words, Book of Ages. And, you know, you open the page and it says Jane Franklin, born March 27th, 1712. And I think, oh, it's going to be an autobiography, like Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. She's going to tell the story of our life and it's going to be this amazing thing because there is no other similar document for such a, you know, poor, ordinary woman. But it's not the story of her life, or it's the story of her life as she understood what story needed telling. It's a chronicle of the births and deaths of her children.
It's so tragic. And to me, as when, I mean, there's a page in your book under the chapter titled Black Day when Jane is 52 years old. And in the course of this year, she writes, you know, June the 12th, 1764, died a beloved and deservedly lamented daughter, Sarah Flagg. November 9th, 1764, died under my care, my daughter Flagg's youngest child, age 17 months. Then March 1765, died my daughter Flagg's second daughter. I mean, it just goes on and on, this chronicle of all these her children and grandchildren that she's outliving.
Yeah. I mean, most of her children grow to adulthood and have children of their own, and then the daughters all die in childbirth, and then the sons, two of them go mad, and the others seem to die of tuberculosis. So she writes to Franklin, you know, sorrows roll upon me like the waves upon the sea. It's not that unusual of an experience in the 18th century. What's unusual is that she has the capacity to write it down. I mean, think about the consequences of all those women not being able to write. There's their domestic sorrows. They can't chronicle them. They're, you know, ministers in Boston, Puritan ministers, tell people, do not get lost in grief. Bound your sorrow. Weep not. There are all kinds of prohibitions on expressing your grief. Jane's completely defying them, even by in some ways, by writing this chronicle. And when she's really felled by grief, not long after the passage that you just mentioned there in 1767, she just stops writing down because she writes, you know, Lord, may I never be so rebellious as to question, you know, Providence, because she's begun to question Providence. By the 1760s, with all the ferment going on with the American Revolution, she's begun to think, maybe all these deaths, maybe this just isn't fair and fated to me, to befall me.
It's impossible to blame her. I mean, to see so many of your loved ones die. I mean, your children especially, who are supposed to outlive you. But Jill Lepore, let me ask you, Benjamin Franklin, one of his most famous works, if not the most famous, is his own autobiography, right? And it's the story of him. And yet in this little document that Jane Franklin puts together, the Book of Ages, which, you know, as you said, you thought, you know, might be her own communication of her own biography, she chooses to write about other people.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what does that tell you?
Well, I find it very moving. And doesn't it resonate how you think about many men and women in your life? I mean, I have gotten so much wonderful correspondence from women writing about how this book made them think about their mother. You know, these are 21st century American women who were raised in the 70s or 80s or 90s even, you know, whose mothers gave up their education to raise their family. And not with regret and not with the kind of agony that Jane endured, but just whose lives were about taking care of other people. And they couldn't really identify, you know, in college when you sit and read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography and he pulls himself up by his bootstraps and he's the rags to riches self-made man. But that story is not everybody's story.
Their lives are lived on these two parallel but intersecting tracks through this amazing portion of history. So much to talk about even just on that point. But why is it that he never mentions her, even though she's the most important member of his family, to him in his autobiography?
Yeah, well, Franklin is a wily, sneaky guy. I love Franklin. I find him hilarious and charming, and he's brilliant, and I enjoy his company immensely. But, I mean, the whole point, he writes that autobiography as a... It's meant to be useful. It's meant to be a guide to young tradesmen, how to sort of rise out of the trades to become a gentleman. It really is like it's like every other piece of advice he ever wrote in Poor Richard's Proverb, or advice to a young tradesman, or the way to wealth. It's industry begets riches, you know. So the women who take care of you and do your laundry do not beget riches. You have to do it all yourself. Like, it's really the story to work, for that narrative to work. It's a myth. He knows it's a myth,
right,
but it's
exactly
a myth, and it can't really be about his sister and, you know, the people he left behind and people who didn't, whose industry did not yield riches. That's not the story he wants to tell. That's not the myth he wants to create.
Except that history, it flows through her life as well. I mean, you write about how in 1766, I believe, or somewhere in the mid-1760s, Jane tries to start a business selling, pieces of clothing or hats that she's made through wonderful materials that Ben Franklin has, fabrics that he sent to her from England, right? And so she does this, and she sits with some of her children doing what she knows how to do best, you know, being with her family and needlepoint, essentially. But what happens? I mean, Ben Franklin himself actually plays a role in the reason why her business may have ended up failing?
Yeah, so Franklin is interviewed by Parliament, and they say, you know, what are the Americans going to do, you know, if they give up English goods? And he said, we'll just wear our old clothes over again. And then that becomes the motto for the boycott, the non-importation agreement. So no one's going to buy fancy hats that Jane's made from, you know, bonnets that she stitches from these lovely fabrics that have come from England, because they're all busy, you know, all the wealthy women of Boston are busy parading around in homespun and, you know, being all pious and about, you know, being advocates of the non-importation agreement. And she gets very testy about that. And her point is, like, the poor are always the ones who suffer in the boycott. Like, that's just... So you can read another whole history of the revolution through her life.
Right. I mean, she writes, you quote a letter from her where she says, "It proves a little unlucky for me that our people have taken it in their heads to be so excessively frugal." She's trying to make her way in the world and earn a little money, and the fervor of revolution sort of threw that off course. But how did the revolution itself, how did that have an impact on her life?
Well, in the immediate sense, I mean, she was terrified of the violence in Boston. She was really fearful for the grandchildren she was taking care of, and then she had to flee the city when most patriots did, when the British occupied the city. And she spent much of the war kind of on the road. She went to Philadelphia to live with Franklin for a while, then she lived in Rhode Island. And she ends up settling back in Boston because she's quite loyal to Boston. But the piece of it that's much more powerful to me is the ideas of the revolution and the way they take root. I mean, she read avidly her whole life. And even if she only read what Benjamin Franklin wrote, which I think she tried to read almost everything that he wrote, she would have had an education unlike almost any other 18th century colonial woman. So she had an education in politics and philosophy that the best Enlightenment thinkers had. And it changed her view about the order of law, really.
Mm. And how do we see that in her writings to her brother?
Well, she first of all becomes just feistier and more argumentative, and she tells him what to read after a while. So she's sort of like taking herself seriously as a person who has ideas. And then she jokes with him about things having to do with equality. And that's the thing that I really care about most, because I think inequality is the thing we desperately need to understand, and to not have a history of it is a huge loss.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a really beautiful passage of one of the letters that she writes to him that you quote, where in the same letter, she keeps apologizing for her spelling, but not for her life, you know, where she writes, "I know the most insignificant creature on earth may be made some use of in the scale of beings, may touch some spirit or verge some wheel unperceived by us." I mean, is she talking about herself there?
She is, and it's so beautiful because she's calling upon both her Christian beliefs, you know, like the fall of a sparrow sort of idea, but on 18th century political philosophy and ideas about individualism that we think of as really modern and really Franklin-esque. That she does feel that her life matters, that every life counts, and when you look at books that she's read, what she copies out and writes to Franklin about are things about people getting a fair try at launching themselves into the world, that we're all created equal.
Why do you think that Benjamin Franklin, through this whole, you know, 60-plus, period of 60-plus years, maintained the correspondence with her?
You know, I think for a couple of reasons. One, I think he does quite adore her. And I think he also feels bad about leaving her. Her fate was different than anyone else in the family. And I think if he'd stayed, she wouldn't have married at 15, and he knows that. She's also his only anchor to his past. I mean, when he comes to Boston, which is only every 10 years, he stays with her. She's the person that attaches him to his roots. He also kind of needs that cred. Like when he's in Paris, you know, swanning around and is pretending to be like a country bumpkin because that gets him a lot of clout at like dinner parties. He has her send some of the family soap, like, please make me some soap and please don't make it especially fine. Like, make me the crumbly greenish kind. And then he gives it away to all the courtiers in Paris to sort of, yes, this is where I come from. Like, this, my sister still makes soap. Like, this gives him all kinds of cred as a man who has made this rise. Like, if your whole story of your life is a rags to riches rise, you need someone who's still in rags to be your anchor.
So what's so interesting to me, Jill Lepore, is that the very thing that draws us and you to the story of Jane Franklin is a thing that must have made her so hard to write about, is that hers is a voice that's not often heard, even less documented in history. We actually have not that much of her writing. I mean, you wrote in The New Yorker that it was writing about her was like trying to paint a phantom.
Yeah, it was a really hard project to do. It's hard to commit to. And I always thank my mother for pushing me to finish it because she really cared about the story. But it felt to me like it's so easy to just look at what I consider the asymmetry of evidence. Like, we knew so much more about men like Benjamin Franklin than we do about, you know, ordinary housewives, widows, whatever, or mothers like Jane Franklin. That, of course, we have this, you know, gazillion pages of biographies of Franklin and no one's ever written about this woman. You can't just look at that and say, okay, that's too bad, because what that does is perpetuate inequality, right? Like, that if we allow the historical record to dictate what we study in an absolute fashion, then we're really left with this incredibly impoverished sense of where we come from.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you write near the tail end of the book that, quote, in the 18th century, history and fiction split. Benjamin Franklin's life entered the annals of history. Lives like his sister's become the subject of fiction, histories of great men, novels of little women, of course, talking about Jane Austen there. But you say Franklin's story doesn't fit neatly on one side of that divide, nor Jane's on the other. But I have to challenge that a little bit. That does seem exactly how, not that she was a little woman, but that history looks upon her experience as one of, you know, many little women.
Yeah, and I think that's true, but I'm not sure that's for the best. So I got really kind of fascinated with the idea, you know, Franklin invented bifocals, you know, so that you could look at things in the distance and up close with the same set of glasses, just, you know, have two lenses in your same frame. Mm-hmm. And I think that historians really ought to work that way. Like, we can't understand Benjamin Franklin without thinking about Jane. Look, she's his most important correspondent. Like, how could we understand him without her? And we can't understand her without him.
Last quick question, a couple seconds we have. You, at the beginning of the book, quote Thomas Gray, who writes, "Some mute, inglorious Milton here may rest when looking upon the graves of poor people." Do we know where Jane Franklin is buried? Is she buried in the Franklin plot at the Granary Burial?
I think she's buried underneath that Franklin monument, and
we
her
think.
Bones, the tomb has probably just been buried underground.
Okay, well, sort of a question mark there at the end of this conversation. But Jill Lepore's new book is Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. It's been shortlisted for the National Book Award. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Listeners, let us know what you think about this conversation or anything you hear at Radio Boston at radioboston.org. Stick with us. There's more of the show in just a moment. This is Radio Boston.